Hello and welcome to recording number 32 of Gary Gygax's Sea of Death, an annotated reading. Today is October 10th, 2021. We left off yesterday, and I'm sorry I had a little hard time reading yesterday, so it's I may have to redo that recording. But we left off yesterday, where things among Gord and his companions were looking pretty bad, and also things weren't looking too good for the Prime Material Plane. Akladra had used the Artifact of Evil to open a gate and summon in demons to fight her battle for her. And Abni had used a statuette that summoned in demons. And then, because Enlita had summoned Zuckmoy, and Zuckmoy saw that because the artifact had been used, it set up like a beacon to all the multiversal people who would and powers who were interested in the artifact. And so there is a general fight going on between. There are upper planar creatures, lower planar creatures, and the very fabric of the Prime Material Plane is in danger. All right. So, at this point, Viron arrives, and he grabs the artifact from Ecladra, which is an interesting thing, because... that artifact was death to the touch. Now, Ecladra had a special box that she got it into from the City Out of Mind. But here, Viron is able to hold it in his own hands. And so Ecladra, you know, Viron is a very practical individual for a senior demon there. And he is parlaying with Gord. And at that, Ecladra feels that Viron is a traitor to Gratst and the other demons. But she's not really in much of a position to do anything about it. So we have Omni appear. And what Viron does is he has Omni... And Lita and Gord and Ecladra seem to be the last, the deck seemed to be cleared. I'm not quite sure how it is invoked, but somehow, with the appearance of Viron, the deck seemed to be cleared, and it appears to be that there's going to be a confrontation between Abmi and Gord and Lita and Ecladra. And although Abmi is very much wanting to kill and bring down Ecladra, Gord steps in his way. Now, Lita and Ecladra are original and clone, and that kind of animosity is born into these clones so that Lita is her overwhelming desire is to kill Ecladra. All right. Now... along with Abmi were some of the surviving members of the Hull Marshes, and Gygax refers to them as wild brigands. Beforehand, the Marshmen were being called the Wenhuli, and from their description, it seemed more like they were a primitive tribe rather than, say, brigands or exiles from Sea Prince society, and I had assumed originally that Gygax had intended them to be perhaps even some fragment of Sewell or Flan that had survived in the Hull Marshes and were generally separate from the culture of the Sea Princes. But there's no telling now with this. All right, I am going to restart right here just as... the confrontation is going on. It's page 372, and I'm going to start on the third paragraph down. Now, we've covered a little of that already, but I want to take a step back. Now, we're very close to the end of the story, about 22 pages. I don't know if we can do that today or not, but maybe we can. The dwarf rushed forward, accelerating at an unbelievable pace thanks to his magical boots. "Gord," said Viron as Abmi began his charge, "you must face that one. The life of Ecclavdra is not his to take or die trying. That opportunity belongs to her clone, the one you named Leda." Without pausing to consider the veracity of the statement, Gord drew his sword and leaped to intercept Abmi's rush. Behind him, his six friends moved to defend him from any other foe who sought to interfere in the duel. The wild brigands from the Hul Marshes gladly went to meet these opponents. As for Ecclavdra, as soon as she laid eyes upon her clone, she made no attention to, no attention to any other, even the onrushing dwarf. In fact, had Gord not intervened, Abmi could have struck the dark elf down with a single blow. Their eyes locked, Ecclavdra and Leda closed with each other and squared off. "I should have known," spat the High Priestess. Leda smiled at the outcry, shouting back, "Yes, you should have, mother, sister, and self." And she laughed at that even as Ecclavdra scowled. "How could it be? You had a telepathic link. I know that now, and I had none. Or did I?" "You didn't, for all I know," Leda said as the two stood only a few feet apart. It was as if a mirror cast this reflection of the other. They were identical twins, cloned and clone. "You failed because of me, that I do know." The triumph evident in Leda's expression was too much for Ecclavdra. Her mouth set in a grimace of fury. Eyes blazing violet evil, she flew at her twin with nothing more than clawed hands and bared teeth. It was not surprising to any onlooker knowing the circumstances that Leda responded in the same manner. The two dark elves collided, locked and fell to roll on the ground in a parody of how females battled when they sought to scratch and claw until one or the other surrendered. This fight, however, was not likely to end until one of the combatants was dead. When the young thief interposed himself between Abmi and the original object of the dwarf's ire, the broad-shouldered servant of the demoness checked his attack. He faced Gord with his pick held ready in both hands. His face bore a sneer of contempt, but there was a crafty gleam in the dwarf's eyes. "I once supposed you a pile of stone, but then I heard you had returned, just as a wart does," rumbled the dwarf, allowing himself a small chuckle at his own joke. "Miracles of that sort don't often happen, lightweight little human. Stand aside and let me slay the drow, or better still for you, join me in the killing of that whore and I will reward you." Gord's longsword flicked out in a lunge, and the dwarf had to bite off his sentence and dance backward. "No, you lying and crooked dung heap," Gord spat back. "No demon-serving dwarf will make bargains with me. After you overcome me, the field is clear to do as you will, but you'll find me no easy foe." The reply was too long, just what Abmi had hoped would happen. As the young adventurer was uttering the last two words, Abmi rushed suddenly to his right, darted in, and swung a two-handed backhand blow with the martel's hammerhead. It was aimed at Gord's left kneecap, but it went high and landed with a meaty thud upon his thigh instead. The young thief was unable to stifle a gasp of pain as the force of the blow buckled his leg. but it was because he toppled that he was able to avoid the next stroke. As Gord was going down, Abney pivoted as on his left heel, executing a full circle with incredible speed and wheeling the martel around as he did so. The long pick was aimed at the left side of the young adventurer's chest. If he had simply dropped in his tracks from the effect of the first wound, the point of the martel would have taken Gord just under the ribs and struck his heart as it hooked upward. However, instead of trying to stand his ground, Gord had used the momentum of the leg blow to help him move to his right, in a motion that turned to a roll and a recovery slightly behind and to the right of where he had been struck. The pick missed its mark by inches, but that was enough. The upswing caught and tore his already tattered smock, exposing the fine mesh of steel he wore beneath it. "Quick as a mouse," Abney snarled, "but this cat's claw of mine will pin you down yet." Gord had to grit his teeth to stand on his wounded leg and appear unhurt. Not only was the dwarf terribly strong, but the martel's hammerhead had small spikes upon it, and the blow it had delivered was very painful. Blood trickled down his leg, and this made Gord both wary and angry. "You are not a cat, dwarf, but a rat. That little nose-picker of yours is no cat's claw. It's just your ratty little teeth." Then, his longsword ready, Gord came slowly forward. "This is a weapon more fitted to a cat, dung pile, and I'll let you feel it in a moment." Abney edged away just as cautiously as his foe approached. He was confident of ultimate victory, especially as he saw the effects of his blow upon the dark-haired lean human. The fellow might be small and quick, a superb swordsman possibly, but his strength and skill would prove no match for the dwarf if Abney but took his time and used his vast store of experience to fullest advantage. The human would lunge at him soon, using the length of his arm and sword in hopes of gaining a hit that the shorter martel would be unable to reply to. But he would be unpleasantly surprised when he tried the attack, for Abney was ready and planning a quick lunge himself. He'd move under the sword and bring the hammerhead up from beneath, using it against the arm this time. Then Gord's attack came, and as the lunge began toward his chest, Abney ducked and began his counter move. A smaller opponent with a shorter, non-thrusting weapon has limited resources in a duel, and Gord understood this well. His lunge was a feint. In a way, he began the strike high, but as he shot his arm forth, he also thrust out his right leg, which lowered his body. The point of the blade went down as it sped out, and the dwarf couldn't duck low enough to escape it. The sword went home cleanly, embedding 6 inches of its bright metal in Abney's right shoulder. Then it darted out, withdrawn in the next instant as Gord managed to back off quickly despite his painfully wounded left thigh. Naturally, the dwarf's countering stroke never came off. "Damn you, man," Abney snarled, his huge beard seeming to bristle in fury as he spoke. His left hand clasped over the place where the sword had struck. The dwarf backed away from his opponent, swinging the martel loosely before him with his right hand to guard his retreat. By concentrating on not yielding to the pain, Gord was slowly bringing his leg back to the point where he could utilize it fully in acrobatic attack maneuvers. The deep wound he had inflicted on Abney would begin to tell soon in any case, he told himself, so there was no need to hurry. He made careful thrusts that did not land, parried swipes of the martel in turn, and readied for a final series to bring the battle to a close. In preparation for the last rush, Gore drew his dagger. As he moved in, he would use the shorter blade to catch the pick, turn it, and leave the way clear for telling work. With his sword. Upon seeing this second weapon, Abmi merely snorted, grabbed the martel with both hands once again, and stood rock still with the pick cocked above his big head. Gord's eyes widened, and he drew back a step as he noticed something shocking. No blood came from the place where he had impaled the dwarf. "You see, don't you?" Abmi laughed. "This is on my side. I'm sorry. Time is on my side, Mouse, not yours. Even as I tell you this, the last of the harm done by your sword is healing itself. Magically. Lay down your weapon now, and I will give you a swift and clean death." As the dwarf should well have known, a swift and clean death was not part of Gord's plan for himself. In fact, he preferred no death at all, and if he had anything to say about it, instead of shrinking back or lowering his weapons, Gord burst forward in a flurry of motion, his body and his sword whirling at blurring speed. Abmi backed away only slowly, deflecting each sword strike with his hammer held before him, while he waited for an opening through which to strike a killing blow. Impatience got the better of the dwarf, and he decided to end things with an overhead stroke, despite two important facts. He needed a second to bring the weapon up before he could use it, and he just stood a good 2 feet shorter than his foe. As Abmi raised the martel over his head, Gord brought his dagger to the fore. When the hammer came back down, the long-bladed dagger rang against the latten of the pick, and the dagger's quillions caught and held the curved spike high as if it were frozen there. Abmi was strong, stronger by far than Gord, but leverage, because of his greater height, was in favor and of the gray-eyed thief for the moment. And a moment was all he needed. Before Abmi could utilize his demon-bestowed strength to fully counter leverage, Gord brought the long blade of his sword in a sweeping blow that struck low. Its half circle of travel before impact lent it terrible force, and the edge bit through flesh and bone despite the metal and leather that protected it. Abmi managed somehow to shove Gord away, for his power was that of a giant despite his small stature. But as Gord tumbled and sprawled backward from the desperate shove, so too fell the dwarf. His left leg had been severed just below the knee. Break. Well, all right. That is a massively powerful blow there. I didn't realize that in this fight description that Gord has just severed Abmi's entire leg. All right, restart right here. We're getting great battle descriptions, but really no specific lore here. We've had Gord take a bad hit, and now Abmi has taken a terrible wound that even his troll-like healing ability may not be able to counter.
It's a good fight description.
Yeah, and Gygax really does. He does wonderful fight descriptions. And so we see here, and this could be seen as kind of a levelist thing, because you can add this fight description to any combat. Now, here we know that Gord and Ami are super high level and with very powerful magic items. But they also have powerful defenses. So I think a lot of things counter each other, you know, in their hit chances and such. And so we have a kind of evenly matched encounter going on here. Ami is strong and a fighter, not just a thief with fighter training. So, and we don't know just whether they're equivalent level, or Ami may even be a higher level fighter than, you know, in game terms. But he certainly isn't the hero of the piece. So that is a big help for Gord, of course. All right, it is page 377, and the second paragraph down from the top. "Tit for tat, rat. Will your magic grow that back?" Gord mocked. Even as he spoke, though, the young thief thought that the stump stopped bleeding almost instantly. And by the time Gord had regained his feet, the pain-racked visage of the dwarf had begun to clear. The young thief stared in amazement as Ami scrambled back to a standing position, using his hammer to help his still-intact leg support his body, while the leg that Gord had severed seemed to grow longer by the minute. Gord was not afraid, but quite confused. Was this Ami some sort of troll? What if the severed leg grew into a second dwarf to fight? Well, he involuntarily considered these questions for a second or two. Gord failed to follow up on his advantage. As he hesitated, Ami tore an ebon crystal from around his neck and hurled it at Gord. Instinctively, the young man sought to deflect the missile with his sword. The black object struck the blade and shattered, and Gord was engulfed in night. Gord lunged and struck then at the place where his foe had been but a moment before. It was too late, of course. In the cloaking darkness, Ami had moved elsewhere. He could hear no sound from the dwarf, but this was not because the blackness surrounding them cloaked noise. And there were noises aplenty in the air as men fought and yelled and died nearby. Unfortunately, these sounds masked any noise that the desperate dwarf might make while doing whatever he was doing. Not wishing to be taken by some other trick of Obmi's, Gord stepped backward as rapidly as he dared, feeling the ground as he did so to avoid a misstep. After 10 such moves, the blackness thinned, and another crabwise step brought him into the sunlight. Paying no heed to the melee around him, Gord began to circle the blot that covered the dwarf. The darkness lay on the land in a hemisphere at least 30 feet across and half as high. As he proceeded to search the perimeter, looking for Ami, if he attempted to escape, Gord's eye happened to fall upon his sword blade. The length of its metal no longer gleamed. The hole was deepest black, and the inky stain was even now spreading downward over the guard and onto the grip toward his hand. With an oath, Gord hurled the weapon from him, fearful that the sooty hue would somehow harm him. As he watched, the blackness crept over his weapon. An idea came to him, a way that he could pursue and find Ami even within the lightless dome he had conjured up. The odor was strong, dwarf. The odor was strong. Dwarf, dwarven blood, dwarven sweat, dwarven breath, too. The huge black leopard waited not an instant to attack. Little motes of light were dancing within the ebony of the blot. But whether the darkness was somehow evaporating or some other Deomer was transforming it, the dwarf was taken completely by surprise when Gourd Panther pounced upon him from the side. Somehow the broad-shouldered demi-human managed to bring his martel to bear, and the weapon inflicted a few wounds upon the sleek, black-furred cat's body. But that, too... But the panther's long fangs sank deep, and its claws tore and raked the dwarf. Then, after absorbing a particularly vicious blow, Gourd Panther managed to seize Obmi's shoulder with his teeth, hold the dwarf's torso fast in his forepaws, and draw the unnatural demi-human into the inescapable embrace, an embrace of death. The rear legs of his leopard body drew up and kicked downward once, twice, thrice, as the foreclaws dug deep and Gourd Panther's jaws closed tighter and tighter. Obmi screamed in agony and attempted to use his magical strength to dislodge the feline attacker. The dwarf had his arms free, so he seized the great cat by its throat and tried to throttle it. Gourd held his teeth fast upon Obmi's shoulder, hardened his muscular cat's throat, and continued to rake with his hind legs. Flesh tore to ribbons, the thick little fingers that had felt like steel bars sinking into his windpipe and jugular, suddenly went limp. Gourd Panther relaxed the grip he had held with forepaws and jaws, but the raking of his rear claws continued on instinct. Obmi's throat rattled, then his gutted body flew a few feet through the air, propelled by the cat's still kicking back legs. In a bound, Gourd was atop the seemingly lifeless body. It was a limp thing, a collection of bloody rags, and a mutilated, eviscerated shambles of what had been a mighty champion of evil. That made no difference to Gourd, for even in his feline killing fury, one thing remained clear in his mind. The dread dwarf had two legs. Gourd Panther picked up the corpse in his jaws and shook it as a terrier shakes a rat. He used claws too, tearing and rending the lifeless body until it was no longer an integral unit, but lay in several pieces. Only then did Gourd allow his panther self to cease its furious assault and slink a short distance away. The darkness was nearly gone now. Nothing more than a haze of black motes that were slowly dissolving. As the last of the motes vanished, and the sun again shed its light upon the torn circle where Obmi had fought his last fight, Gourd stood again as a man. "Gourd, I thought I saw a great black panther in that, but by the great horn spoon, Barrel's ugly face marred still further, by a long cut across his cheek." Pardon me. Page turning here. Lost its grin as he spoke. The burly man's eyes were riveted on the shambles before him. Following Barrel's gaze, Gourd too muttered a shocked oath. The torn bits of the dwarf were pulsing, moving, creeping toward each other. "That vile bastard still lives," Gourd shouted. The cry brought Delver and Shade on the run. It was the dwarf who spoke first. "That one is like a troll, Gourd. Keep those hunks of flesh apart from one another, and all build a fire quickly. Then when it's going, we toss in all the pieces. Burning is the only way to finish such a thing as that. Gord set about his task, while the other three kept busy at the strange and grisly business of prodding and pushing the pieces so that they could not come together. "The other three are in bad shape, Captain," Barrel said to Gord as they worked. "We've got 'em resting on the other side of that little hillock." "We'll tend to them soon," said Gord sincerely. "But, much as I hate to say it, what we're doing right now is more important than all three of their lives. Or ours either, for that matter." "Aye, Captain," said Barrel, who did not really need to be impressed with the seriousness of the situation, as he contended with the scuttling bits of flesh and bone. Minutes later, the fire was ready, and they all took up pieces one by one and threw them into the flames. Dark, pungent smoke plumed everywhere, plumed skyward, and it was over. Ami the dwarf, servant of evil, champion of demons, was no more. Gord imagined he heard a wailing, the nearly inaudible sound of an evil life force lamenting as it went off to its end in the lowest of the lower hells. Barrel had gone back to check on their three injured comrades, while Gord witnessed the dwarf's final undoing. The burly seaman trudged back up to his captain with tears glistening in his eyes. "Dozier and Smoker seem like they'll be okay," he said, putting his hand upon the young thief's shoulder. "But poor Post is a goner." "When does this end?" Gord said to himself more than anyone else. Then, shaking his head to clear away the depression, it occurred to him that the battleground was more empty than it should have been. "Where are the others?" he asked. "What's happened to the white demon, Leda, Eclavdra?" "Those three were right over there," Shade answered, pointing to the spot where Gord had first laid eyes on Viron and Eclavdra. "I happened to be looking there because a pair of Obmi's wild men were headed for the two females, the Dark Elves." "Leda and Eclavdra," Gord supplied. "I went for the men, thinking to take 'em both on, but the pale demon did something and it, and both of the drow just vanished." Then the half-elf added as an afterthought, "Those lousy marshers were so startled at that I did for them both without much trouble at all." "I guess they were the last left alive." "Let's see to the wounded," Gord replied after a few seconds of contemplation, "and then we'll worry about what's happened to the rest." As the four started toward the place where Dozier and Smoker lay unconscious, the earth shook and rumbled. Steam spurted up through a fissure that opened at their feet, and the group jumped back as quickly as they could. Then the ground erupted in a gout of smoke and flame, and the blaze of the fire and blackness of the fumes obscuring the vision of all four. Break. That is the end of chapter 24.
It's page... And the end of Obmi.
And the end of Obmi, yes. So Obmi, for all that, comes to his terrible end. And it does kind of point then. Now, we've been having this little discussion because my feeling is that Gygax has had the G modules and G1, G2, G3 especially. G3 introduced Obmi and Eclavdra. Now, those were old tournament modules. And my feeling is that with the drow being known in both the City of Greyhawk and actually being in Divers, where, there were drow and half-drow that came to the aid were sent out with the Clavdra on her mission, and a Temple of Gratz there, that the Giant series happened well before, you know, these other adventures. It actually happened when Gord was either very young or, you know, maybe not even born, because, you know, the Drow are well known by the time Gord is an older teenager and he's Black Cat. The people of the Greyhawk think Black Cat may be a Drow thief. So, I'm thinking that, you know, with Obmi and Eclavdra dead in the Gord storyline, they obviously are not part of the Giants. And at the time, Eclavdra was worshipping the Elder Elemental Evil, or the Elder Elemental Eye. I forgot what it was called back then. But that was before it was supposedly found out to be a trick by Uz and Yggdrasil. So, you know, we have Eclavdra developing her character from that point. And I really think the whole, you know, Chill Giant Chief, Ice Giant, Fire Giant, that those are adventures that in Gygax's Gord continuity happened well before. And I wonder what, you know, whether that was a consideration of how he viewed the published campaign. All right. We are going to restart. There are 12 pages left. We have about 24 minutes, and I don't know. There's a possibility we're going to finish tonight. And it is page 382, the beginning of chapter 25 and the first paragraph. The Alabaster Demon Lord stood on a circle of ground that appeared as bright and fresh as a morning meadow. The grass was green and sparkling with dew. Little flowers tipped their faces toward the sun overhead. No sign of struggle, blood, or death was visible upon this unspoiled disk. Beside the tall, thin being from the abyss stood Leda. At least it appeared to Gord to be her, for her garments were those that Eclavdra's clone had worn just today, and her sword was the very one she had taken from the dead Yole warrior what seemed like an age ago. The demon merely regarded the four warriors with his red-pink eyes, and the dark elf spoke. "Gord, you live! You have actually slain Obmi," she cried, smiling and coming toward him as she spoke, her arms opening and then embracing him as she got close. Gord was tempted to return her embrace, but instead he remained stiff and unresponsive. "Yes," he said without emotion, "I killed the dwarf." At his cold reaction and toneless words, Leda released her grip on his torso and stepped back from him, her face showing hurt. Gord disregarded that. "What of Eclavdra?" he inquired in the same emotionless voice. "Eclavdra is gone, finished, only Leda lives. Is there a difference?" Now the dark elf's beautiful face showed both hurt and anger. "How can you, of all who know me, ask such a question?" "Much has occurred since last I thought I knew you, Leda. How am I, a poor simple man, to know the truth of anything?" Viron laughed, a musical, silvery, cold laugh at that. "Well put, Gord of Greyhawk. Yet even demons must often labor under the same burden which you claim. Allow me to assure you that this is indeed Leda, not the one from whom she sprang, and there is a difference. Truth from the mouth of a demon." Again Viron laughed. "Yes, strange things occur frequently, and there is yet more." Delver, Shade, and Barrel had been close to their friend when the strange appearance of demon and drow occurred. Each was clasping his weapon, prepared to fight a hopeless fight to the last against this supernatural enemy. Now they were confused and uncertain, just as Gord was. Delver growled a warning which was supported by Barrel's advice to beware the words of demons, Captain. Shade merely shook his long-haired head and took a step closer to the young thief, his weapon pointing at the snow-white Viron. Without any apparent offense taken at the reactions of the four, the demon lord slowly lowered his head to gaze at the sword at his feet. With a slight gesture and a soft series of sounds, Viron caused a chest of beaten brass to appear at his feet, and out of thin air. The final keyed gourd lies therein, the demon said, indicating the container. Perhaps you will allow me to explain what has happened before you decide to do what you must do. Explain, or do you mean tell me what I am to do? Gourd shot back with contempt. Oh, no, I can by no means tell you what to do, Gourd of Greyhawk. Your courage is very much your own, and even a demon lord of my power is unable to alter that fact. Still, I can alter a few things. And as he spoke, the alabaster being looked away from the four who stood staring at him by the place a few paces away where the body of Post lay. I heal you, man, the demon pronounced. Post's chest heaved. He groaned, and then the lean man sat up, rubbing his eyes as if just awakening from a night's sleep. Viron turned his glance to the injured pair, Smoker and Dozier. You too have likewise fought bravely. Be whole. Smoker rolled over on his side and began snoring peacefully, while the brown-skinned Changa sat up and looked at his friends with a white-toothed smile, not knowing what to say. Gourd did have a reply to these acts. You use demon powers to bribe me, to bemuse and befuddle my mind. I am unmoved, Viron. That is exactly as I thought, the pale creature said. The gesture was simply meant to take concern for your comrades from your mind. It must be free of such worries. Gourd of Greyhawk, if it is to be properly absorbed, what I now ask your permission to relate. After a few seconds of consideration, Gourd nodded. I will hear your words, Viron, with as much disinterest as is possible for one such as I. That is considerable, I assure you, but your attention is all I ask. Now I will relate what has transpired. The demon lord said, sinking to a sitting position on the long grass. The four disliked doing so, but they too sat warily when Leda followed Viron's example, taking a position between the demon and the group of men and demi-humans. Now pay full attention, said Viron in a contented tone. What I have to say is rather lengthy. All right, break. So here we have Viron able to to heal and to bring Post either back from death or from the very, doorstep of death right there. I think it's more that Post was not quite dead or not entirely dead. And so rather than being brought back to life by Viron, he's simply brought back from very close to death. And as Chris says, it's a shame nobody grabbed Obmi's girdle. So that goes into the fire. Now that Martell is still around, but I assume it's a weapon of very, very evil. So we lost the Boots of Speed that Obmi had been wearing. All right.
I didn't know that demons could heal like that.
Gratzt is allowing Leda and Eclavdra clerical power.
Yeah, true.
I'm not sure if there has been a game write-up of Vuron or not. So I really haven't, I don't believe I've seen anybody trying to come up with what kind of powers he actually possesses.
Yeah, I wonder if he has clerics or anything.
No, you know, that is a good question. Gratz does. I mean, Gratz has, you know, not only does he have a high priestess, Winnie Clavdra, or had one, but Lita is actually mentioned at one point that she channels her healing abilities and her magical abilities through Gratz, even though, you know, she isn't worshiping him. She has been trained in using those powers. So it might be a thing of Gratz noticing and shutting out that conduit. But back in, you know, Lita's magical abilities, they were all clerical and they were all coming from Gratz and noted as such in the story. All right. It is page number 384. And it is the final paragraph. When the contest for the Theopark commenced, I brought Lita into being. She is not and never was a true clone of Eclavdra, for never would I replicate such a one as that drow was. If ever a mortal creature could have visited ruin upon my liege lord, that one could have. I altered Lita, as you named her, Gord, and did what I could to aid her. Being as I am a demon, I could not place any goodness within her, not even any balance or neutrality. She now possesses some modicum of both, and that is because of you, Gord of Greyhawk. All right, break. So Gygax once more is stepping into bringing the game mechanics into the setting material. Now, I personally would never go there myself. I can take it as a philosophy that they call neutrality for, like, you know, balance or neutrality. That's fine. I can take it that they refer to people as good or evil, chaotic or lawful, as, you know, part of the indicators of what they think they are like. But I really dislike this idea that the alignment system is part of the setting itself. So I this business with Vuron, I find that very poor that Viron's talking about Lita's alignment. All right, I'm going to restart. And it is page 385 in the second paragraph from the end. Do you state blame or proffer some credit toward me, Vuron? Your words make no sense. Oh, but they do. As for blame, I just might harbor that against you for many reasons. But I also balance that with much credit for what you did, Gord. The clay of the Almost clone was molded by you, even if just a little. This version of Eclavdra, this Lita, can never act as the original did. There is no longer any threat to my lord. Perhaps I rue those words, demons. Why should I be interested in what benefits the denizens of the abyss? Rest assured that the influence of the departed drow would have been baneful in many ways, Gord of Greyhawk. She would have brought destruction to your world, ruin to mine own realm, and all the others of the demon kind too. Yes, Gord, Lita interjected urgently. It was Vuron's work, which gave me the telepathic power to influence Eclavdra, without her knowing it. Without such an advantage, she would have taken the final key, but for a brief time, only to lose it to Obmi and his mistress. One demon or another, what does it matter? All humanity loses either way. Be not so quick to decide, Gord of Greyhawk. You now, Vuron said in his clear, sexless voice, what I tell you now centers on that very matter, on the final key, and certainly on the fate of all who have all we know as the multiverse. I am to decide this, Gord uttered a mocking laugh in disbelief. When I intervened in Eclavdra's actions, Viron said without commenting to Gord's multiverse. When I intervened in Eclavdra's actions, Viron said, without commenting on Gord's utterance, she had violated the compact regarding the Theopart. Struggling here to turn the page, and I could take it from her. Once this was done, I could use its power for but a moment to undo what the foolish drow had wrought. Despite those facts, I have no power to claim the final key. You or Leda must decide what is to be done with it. You mean? Yes, you could take it now and in an instant present it to the Demiurge. Vasilev might even accept it. Leda spoke then, her voice heavy with emotion. One thing is sure, Gord, I will not be the arbiter of this. I yield my right to you. What is she saying, Gord of Greyhawk? I'm sorry, what she is saying, Gord of Greyhawk, the pale demon explained, is that she could challenge you for the final key. Whichever of you survived would then possess the right to dispose of it. But Leda gives you her right. She will not fight against you. And that is evidence of the effect you have made upon her persona. This placed Gord in a terrible quandary. Vasilev and Rexfulus, the Cat Lord as well, had charged him with this very same responsibility. Long, long ago, at the time Gord had first set out on the quest for the last portion of the artifact, both of his mentors had said that the ultimate decision would be his, should he actually succeed in gaining possession of the final key. Now Leda, once his beloved, distrusted uncertainty, and Viron a hated foe, a demon lord of unknown power and certain evil, both placed the same decision squarely upon his head. I could give the thing over to Vasilev, Gord said. Viron nodded affirmatively. Lord and Kanan, the Cable, Uz, the Brotherhood, anyone. To each question, the alabaster demon indicated a positive answer. Finally, the young thief asked, myself. I could keep and wield the power for myself. You could hold the Theopart for as long as fate allowed, Gord of Greyhawk. Whether you could employ it is unknown to me, but I think that somehow you would manage. What am I to do with the cursed thing? Being nothing more nor less than a demon lord, Viron said without force, I cannot say. Gord looked at Leda. Now she seemed again like the beautiful dark elf he had grown to love as they adventured across the barren plains and onto the ashen desert. No longer a stranger, a drow, and a priestess of demons. Her return gaze was warm. Her violet eyes were deep pools of emotion that he could only interpret as love for him. And you, Leda, have you any words for me on this matter? If you will truly hear them, Gord, with your heart as well as your mind. He gave a tiny shrug, a little gesture of hopelessness. I am what I am. I can hear only as I can. But I will try, Leda, to listen with all of my being. Then I will speak to you, love, even though what I must say is so painful that I would rather die now than say what I believe. Good can never possess the artifact, no part of it, not even its essence. Should those who stand between good and evil, and between law and chaos obtain the Theopart, it will at least corrupt and change them to suit its nature. The possessor of such a thing must surely come to be like the one to whom it is linked, or else The theopart will bring ruin. Gord cocked his head at that. Ruin? How so? The power of the artifact flows through each of its parts. Each calls to the other. Each seeks to place itself in the hands of those attuned to its nullity. It will be united, or it will bring destruction on any being preventing its conjoining. Then, either whomever I bestow the final key upon is doomed, or I bring doom to all the world. Euron responded to that. Not exactly, but Lita's words and your understanding are almost perfect. In this matter, the artifact must always exist, and if it remains in its separate parts, there must always be tension and conflict as the portions exert their influence. Only one force can now be used. Sorry here. To keep them from being joined, Gord of Greyhawk, but the selection must be yours. More cannot be said. Quite a lore. The temptation to employ evil to overthrow evil, Gord murmured in observation. Break. So we have a very Lord of the Rings situation here where, again, the power of the ring is evil and will find its way to corrupt. I think that's one of the great weaknesses of this entire Theopart and Tharaston storyline, is that it is just really so much of the ideas and everything are lifted from Tolkien. How much more would I have enjoyed 7 different novels that talked of adventures, like each one an adventure novel, that Gygax had written, say the first about Gordon Chur, and then 6 more adventure novels. That would have been so much more than the Tharaston storyline. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 388. It is almost 9 o'clock. We have 6 pages left to do. I hope people can stay, but I am going to press through and finish this. All right. Euron said nothing to that, but Lita came close to him and placed her arm around his hunched shoulders. Even the greatest and wisest of the minions of good would fall to such a lure, Gord. If any faction of good or evil holds 2 parts, the 3rd part would be subject to the other 2, and the whole artifact would conjoin. But yet, is there not the force of concordance? Is there? Lita asked softly. No, I am not reasoning properly, Gord admitted. Those who hold to the necessity of awe and seek balance are too weak to oppose the others. They would be assailed from all sides, by good and evil alike. The key would fall into their hands soon enough, and the inevitable would then result. I think you should destroy the blasted thing, Captain, Beryl ventured weakly. Would that such an option existed, Euron said, with such emotion that it amazed all. Not even the greatest of deities could safely do that. To try is to bring ruin, for the thing would then unite as all other forces became disrupted in sympathy, and he who must sleep forever would then awaken. Evil alone can possess these theoparts, Gord said in amazement, realizing the final truth of the matter. Each of the keys had been resting with those of malign sort, although none knew it at the time. That is correct, Gord of Greyhawk, Voron said again, without expression in his voice. But only the chaos of the abyss seeks to keep the artifact disjoined. For the proud and independent rulers of demonkind would not willingly bow to any. Again, you relate the facts as they exist, Viron observed unemotionally. Then you, Viron, must accept the final key. It was a demand, not a request or statement. Perhaps, the alabaster-hued demon lord said slowly. Viron nodded, looking squarely at Gord with his red eyes. Yes, perhaps, but even one who wields the might of the Theopart cannot force that object upon another, if that one is unwilling. You're telling me that, you, and your master too, willing to possess the thing. I am willing only under certain conditions, Gord of Greyhawk. As for my liege, I must serve him as best I am able. But the devil-serving brotherhood holds one, and us the other. If either of them should gain this portion, then all are doomed. That is correct, but what difference if my acceptance spells eventual doom anyway? Gord stared at the pale being in bewilderment for a moment, then asked, "The conditions, what are they?" Lita must accompany the final key. She must go with it as Eclavdra, High Priestess of Gratst. You must agree to this first. Then you must willingly give over the Theopart to her, and then she and I will depart with it, Viron said slowly and clearly. Never, I will never, never consign the one I love to the abyss. Lita embraced him, kissing him tenderly, holding him as she murmured words of endearment. The pleasure lasted all too brief a time. Then she spoke. But you must, my love. I am willing, for if I were not, then all Earth should be ruined. Think of all, not of me or yourself. The price we each must pay is nothing in the balance of all. Gord pushed her away in a fury of disbelief. What is this demon's trick, Viron? No deception, Gord of Greyhawk. Lita speaks as must be spoken. As Eclavdra, an Eclavdra with more than selfishness and lust for power within herself, she alone can mitigate against the force. That the final key will assert. My liege will accept such influence. I think if any help is possible in this matter, possession of the final key will bring woe upon us, but my rede is that it will not ultimately destroy him or the whole of the abyss if this drow is there to assist me. She must come, or else I must refuse the Theopart. For minutes Gord sat in stunned silence, his mind reeling frantically, seeking some different solution. Lita seemed to realize the instant when he finally gave in. You know what you must do, my dearest one. Yes, I know, Lita, Gord answered. There is an inescapable conclusion, and I understand I must now face it. I will all love you always, Gord, even when I must become more and more Eclavdra and less myself. I know. Then you must do as Viron says. But I am not ready to give you up yet. Can we have time for a proper farewell at least? There is no time, love. Even the power of the final key cannot maintain this static condition for long, unless it passes to me soon, and I to the deeps of the abyss. There will be what was here before, all alignments contending in a struggle of doom. Gord bent and kissed her then, a long, lingering kiss of farewell. It had to last him forever, and he knew it. Then he stepped back, holding her shoulders at arm's length. You're free to act, Lita, my loved one. Do as you must. I do not resist your decision. But be it as it may, I freely give you the final key. There was no feeling in his voice as he uttered those words. No light in his eyes as he spoke. Lita took his hands briefly, then allowed hers to trail slowly from his grasp in a last unspoken goodbye. I'm ready now, Viron, she told the pair, the pale demon lord, as she picked up the brass coffer. Eclavdra, high priestess and champion of Gratst, declares victory in his name and commands you to carry me and the prize I have won to him. Viron said not a word, but he looked at Gord with what might have been sympathy. His gaze moved aside, fixing on a spot not far from where the young adventurer sat. Then Leda, Eclavdra, stepped to a position beside the demon, and the two disappeared without a sound. His friends looked at him in stunned silence, none daring to speak. Gord didn't notice. He sat slowly, bowed his head, and remained that way in silence, eyes open, but not looking at anything. He sat this way for so long that the ones who waited for him might have thought him dead, except for the shallow breathing that was barely discernible to those closest to him. Finally, Shade sat down next to him and spoke. You did as a hero would do, Gord. I speak for all when I tell you that none of us would have had the wit or the will to do so brave a thing as you have done. The young man lifted his head and turned his gray eyes toward the half-elf, but Shade could detect nothing within their depths. The gaze was flat and bore no hint of what lay beyond the windows of his mind. Then Beryl approached deferentially. Your sword, Captain. I found it just laying in the grass and figured you'd be wanting it soon. Gord accepted the proffered weapon without a comment. Then he looked down again, his eyes still dead, and his face a mask. Everyone else simply waited as the sky turned to a leaden gray and a drizzle of cold rain began to fall. Gord didn't seem to notice it would be a long afternoon and a longer night. Break. End of chapter 25. Chapter 26 is very short, and I'm going to jump right into it. And it is page 392, first paragraph. Ain't much of a place, Beryl said disdainfully, gesturing to indicate that the remark referred to the whole of Dahl Port. I thought, big-bellied one, that it came from this place, Dozier said with mock wonder at the burly man's expression of distaste. All right, break. Dahlport is Port Tolly. So they've made it. We're jumping to the very end here, and they're in Port Tolly. All right, begin. We're on 392, paragraph 3. Sure, sure, Beryl agreed. The Sea King's Lands is where I was born, as all babes must be birthed. But I was raised aboard a ship, and it's the smell of salt air and the sound of wind in the rigging that I long for now, ye sun-baked lubber. He made a mock gesture of anger that even the Chenga could not fail to interpret as jesting. Beryl's right, Smoker agreed. This town is about as dirty and dull as I've ever seen. What say, Gord? I'm ready to see the last of this place if you are. Delver rumbled his affirmation at that. We dwarven folk aren't known as seafarers, Captain, but as far as I'm concerned, Beryl said it, even a sea voyage is better than spending another night in Dahl Port. At that, Shade laughed, and Post too chuckled. That's unanimous, Gord, for the two of us can't disagree, Post said. For the half-elf and himself. It's up to you. Oh, because you're the one we elected as leader, and nobody's taken that back yet. Yet, what does that mean, Post? These flaming floors, Captain, the lean man exclaimed. You don't really expect us to agree to elect you permanent captain, do you? Even Gord had to laugh at that. Well, I just don't know what to do next, he said then. With a serious tone. There are a number of possibilities. Not at all, Beryl was adamant. There's a vessel leaving for a cruise along the coast of Western Jungle tomorrow. The ticket for us. And there's places left we can take. Why, with a bit of luck, we'll all come out as rich as the potentates of them places Dozier keeps talking about. Even if we don't make it big exactly, the master of that ship, the Slobberin' Sea Lion or something like that, tells me he's headed for the Ulluk Prince's state to trade when he's done with the jungle savages. With the wealth we pick up there, we can... Enough, Gord said with a sigh of resignation. I guess a little sailing on the seas of Earth is bound to do me some good. Seeing as how the rest of you seem to have already made up your minds, I'll go along with the decision. First thing in the morning, we sign up with the Sovereign Sea Lion, he said, casting a sly glance at Barrel as he corrected the man's pronunciation. For better or worse, we'll be sailing the sea as free traders by tomorrow afternoon. For a second, Barrel considered pointing out that true sailors didn't consider Jade Bay part of the sea, although it was a good-sized body of water. Then we'd better be prepared, boys, he caroled happily to the others. Setting sail tomorrow means we've a heap of funnin' to do tonight. It just won't do to board a new ship without an aching head and a flat purse, you know. All six managed to get a grasp on some portion of Gord. By pulling and pushing, a laughing band directed their leader toward the line of taverns that stood near the wharf. Harold was the most experienced sailor of the lot, and there was no profit in disagreeing with such a learned opinion. Soon I will see the true wonders of the East, Dozier said to Gord. The young thief couldn't tell for sure if the dark-eyed Changa was serious or pulling his leg. Somehow, it didn't really matter. In a few minutes, there would be beakers of wine and lusty songs to fill his mind with meaninglessness. Tomorrow was tomorrow, and there was no merit in knowing either it or truth right now. The light of dawn made the waters of Dalport's deep pool a bright mirror, and for a short time the winds were calm, keeping the big ship motionless upon the surface of the bay. Then the heat of the rising sun brought a breeze from the land. The sails flapped idly at first, then filled and grew taut. The wind pushed the Sovereign Sea Lion southward, and in its stout, limbered hull its crew and others raised a cheer. Even the ship seemed to leap at that, as glad in its own way as the life aboard it was, to be making for distant ports and for places. A solitary, muffled figure stood watching from the docks as the ship's creamy sails grew smaller and soon were but a black speck disappearing on the horizon. The figure stayed until the ship vanished entirely. Then it turned, mingled with the passing throng, and was lost. All right. That is the end of Gygax's Sea of Death.
Three down, four to go.
I know. And a little bit of hint of what's to come. I've read people, they say that they get right into the last two books, skip City of Hawks, they skip Night Errant, and they jump into Come Endless Darkness. Now, I don't think that's the way to go. The first three books were written 1, 2, 3. They're part of the same series. Night Errant is a melange of short stories that take place kind of between the two, between Night Artifact of Evil and Sea of Death. And I really think that's our next step. We read Night Errant. We read the story from Dragon 100. At midnight, Black Cat comes. And then we step back into the early days of Gord, rewritten by Gygax for New Infinities called City of Hawks. All right.
Sounds good.
There was some comment on Port Tully, but really, there really wasn't much lore there. Some ideas that we can use, but very, very brief description. And I don't think much that anybody thinking about the Sea Prince's pirate port hasn't considered. So I'm going to leave it there. And so that's the end of Sea of Death. And I'll see you hopefully tomorrow with the beginning of Knight Errant.
I'd like telling how he came out of the temple with his crew. I thought that was a nice touch.
Yes. Yeah, I found a few things. I really, you know, I didn't understand really that why they wouldn't have left together in one big, with all the rebels, you know, going together in one big thing. But no, keeping his little crew and they're intact here. With the idea of adventures to come, I think that this conclusion is much better, and I would like to have seen Gygax a happier individual and just had more adventures to come rather than, do Knight Errant and then start a new series. You know, I'd like to have seen him writing these Greyhawk stories right up to the end of his life, which would have been a good couple decades or a decade and a half later.
Yep, it would have been nice.
It would have been, but things are what they are. Well, that is it, and good night. I'm going to jump over to Jay's right after this.
Me too.
All right.